which swept the ocean, struck the island. The waters they disgorged ran partly out to sea in surface rivers, seeped partly into the heart of the island. Billions of tons of water thus crept down into the secret reservoirs of the island. They did not stay there, of course, for since the rock was porous, there were avenues that led back out to sea, and in time the water was lost. But if any animal, a man perhaps, could penetrate the rocks, he could intercept the water and put it to his use, for the entire island was a catchment. The entire core of the island was permeated with life-giving water. But that was not the special treasure of this particular island, for a man could bore into almost any porous rock on any island and catch some water. Here on this island there was to be an extra treasure, and the way it was deposited was something of a miracle. When the ice came and went, causing the great ocean to rise, when the island itself sank slowly and then rebuilt with new lava, when these titanic convolutions were in progress, the south shore of the island was alternately exposed to sunlight or buried fathoms deep in ocean. When the first condition prevailed, the exposed shore was cut by mountain streams which threw their debris across the plain, depositing there clay-like soils and minute fragments of lava. Sometimes the sea would wash in bits of animal calcium, or a thundering storm would rip away a cliff face and throw its remnants over the shore. Bit by bit, over 100,000 years at a time, the shore accumulated its debris. Then, when next the ocean rose, it would press down heavily upon this shelving land, which would lie for ages submerged under tons of dark green water. But while the great brutal ocean thus pressed down hydraulically, it at the same time acted as a life-giving agent, for through its shimmering waves filtered silt and dead bodies and waterlogged fragments of trees and sand. All these things, the gifts both of land and sea, the immense weight of ocean would bind together until they united to form rock. Cataclysmically, the island would rise from the sea to collect new fragments washed down from the hills, then sink beneath the waves to accumulate new deposits of life-building slime. But whenever the monstrous ocean would beat down heavily upon the shore for 10,000 years at a time, new rock was formed, an impermeable shield that sloped down from the lower foothills and extended well out to sea. It was a caprock, imprisoning in a gigantic underground reservoir all that lay beneath it. What lay trapped below, of course, was water. Secretly, far beneath the visible surface of the island, imprisoned by this watertight cap of rock, lay the purest, sweetest, most copious water in all the lands that bordered upon or existed in the great ocean. It lay there under vast pressure, so that it was not only available, should a man deduce its secret hiding, but it was ready to leap forth 20 or 30 or 40 feet into the air, and engulf with life-giving sweetness any man who could penetrate the imprisoning rock and set it free. It waited, an almost inexhaustible supply of water to sustain life. It waited, a universe of water hidden beneath the caprock. It waited. The adventurous plants and insects that had reached the earliest Northwest Island had plenty of time in which to make their way to the newer lands as the latter rose to life. It might take 1,000,000 years for a given grass to complete its journey down the chain, but there was no hurry. Slowly, with a patience that is difficult to comprehend, trees and vines and crawling things crept down the islands, while in other parts of the world a new and more powerful animal was rising and preparing himself for his invasion of the islands. Before the two-volcanoed island with its trapped treasure of water had finished growing, man had developed in distant areas. Before the last island had assumed its dominant shape, men had erected in Egypt both mighty monuments and a stable form of government. Men could already write and record their memories. While volcanoes still played along the chain, China developed a sophisticated system of thought, and Japan codified art principles that would later enrich the world. While the islands were taking their final form, Jesus spoke in Jerusalem, and Muhammad came from the blazing deserts with a new vision of heaven. But no man knew the heaven that awaited them on these islands. For these lands were the youngest part of the earth's vast visible surface. They were new. They were raw. They were empty. They were waiting. Books which we still read today were written before these islands were known to anyone except the birds of passage. Songs which we still sing were composed and recorded while these islands remained vacant. The Bible had been compiled, and the Koran. Raw, empty, youthful islands, sleeping in the sun and whipped by rain, they waited. Since, when they were finally discovered, they were destined to be widely hailed as paradises, it is proper to study them carefully in their last waiting moments, those sad, sweet, overpowering days before the first canoes reached them. They were beautiful, that is true. Their wooded mountains were a joy. Their cool waterfalls existing in the thousands were spectacular. Their cliffs, where the restless ocean had eroded away the edges of great mountains, dropped thousands of feet clear into the sea, and birds nested on the vertical stones. Rivers were fruitful. The shores of the islands were white, and waves that washed them were crystal blue. At night, the stars were close, great brilliant dots of fire fixing forever the location of the islands and forming majestic pathways for the moon and sun. How beautiful these islands were, how shot through with harmony and peace. How the mind lingers on their pristine grandeur, a grandeur that nothing so far devised could permanently destroy. If paradise consists solely of beauty, then these islands were the fairest paradise that man ever invaded, for the land and sea were beautiful, and the climate was congenial. But if the concept of paradise includes also the ability to sustain life, then these islands, as they waited in the time of Jesus and Muhammad, were far from heavenly. They contained almost no food. Of all the things that grew on their magnificent hillsides, nothing could be relied upon to sustain life adequately. There were a few pandanus trees, whose spare and bitter fruits could be chewed for minimum existence. There were a few tree ferns, whose cores were just barely edible. A few roots. There were fish if they could be caught, and birds if they could be trapped. But there was nothing else. Few more inhospitable major islands have ever existed than this group. Here are the things they did not have. No chickens, or pigs, or cattle, or edible dogs. No bananas, no taro, no sweet potatoes, no breadfruit. No pineapple, or sugar, or guava, or gourds, or melons, or mangoes. No fruit of any kind. No palms for making sugar. No food. The islands did not even have that one essential, that miraculous sustainer of tropical life, the coconut. Some had drifted to the shores, but in salty soil along the beaches they could not grow. Any man who came to the islands would, if he wanted to live, have to bring with him all food. If he were wise, he would also bring most of the materials required for building a civilized society, since the islands had no bamboo for decorating a home, no candle nuts for lamps, no mulberry bark for making tapa. Nor were there any conspicuous flowers, neither frangipani, nor hibiscus, nor bright croton, nor colorful orchids. Instead of these joy-giving, life-sustaining plants, there was a hidden tree, useless except that its wood, when dried, yielded a persistent perfume. And this was the tree of death, the sandalwood tree. Of itself, it was neither poisonous nor cruel. But the uses to which it would be put on these islands would make it a permanent blight. The soil of the islands was not particularly good. It was not rich and black like the soil which Russian peasants were already farming, nor loamy and productive like that known to the Dakota and Iowa tribes of Indians. It was red and of a sand-like consistency, apparently rich in iron because it had been formed of decomposed basalt, but lacking in other essentials. If a farmer could add to this soil the missing minerals and supply it with adequate water, it had the capacity to produce enormously. But of itself it was not much, for the minerals were absent, and so was the water. Tremendous quantities of rain did fall on the islands, but it fell in an unproductive manner. From the northeast, trade winds blew constantly, pushing ahead of them low clouds pregnant with sweet water. But along the northeast shores of each island, high cliffs rose, and mountains, and these reached up and knocked the water out of the clouds, so that it fell in cascades where it could not be used, and never reached the southwest plains where the red soil was. Of the flatlands that could be tilled, fully three-fourths were, in effect, deserts. If one could capture the wasted water that ran useless down the steep mountainsides and back out to sea, bringing it through the mountains and onto the flatlands, then crops could be grown. Or if one could discover the secret reservoirs waiting in the kidneys of the islands, one would have ample water and more than ample food. But until this was accomplished, men who lived on these islands would never have enough water or enough food. And so, these beautiful, inhospitable islands waited for some breed of men to invade them with food and courage and determination. The best that could be said of the islands as they waited was that they held no poisonous snakes, no fevers, no mosquitoes, no disfiguring diseases, and no plagues. There was one additional aspect that must be remembered. Of all the growing things that existed in these islands at the time of Jesus, 95 out of every 100 grew nowhere else in the world. These islands were unique, alone, apart, off the mainstream of life, a secluded backwater of nature. Or, if you prefer, an authentic natural paradise where each growing thing had its opportunity to develop in its own unique way, according to the dictates and limitations of its own abilities. I spoke of that adventurous bird that brought the first seed in its bowels. It was a grass seed, perhaps, one whose brothers and sisters, if the term may be used of grasses, stayed behind on their original islands, where they developed as the family had always done for millions of generations. On those original islands, the grass maintained its standard characteristics and threw forth no venturesome modifications. Or, if such mutations were offered, the stronger, normal stock quickly submerged them, and the dead average was preserved. But on the new islands, the grass, left alone in beauty and sun and rain, became a different grass, unique and adapted to these islands. When men looked at such grass millions of years later, they would be able to discern that it was a grass and that it had come from the original stock still existing elsewhere. But they would also see that it was nevertheless a new grass, with new qualities, new vitality, and new promise. Did an insect from one of the huge continents reach these islands? If so, here he became a different insect, his legs longer or his nose more adapted to boring. Birds, flowers, worms, trees, and snails all developed unique forms and qualities in these islands. There was then, as there is now, no place known on earth that even began to compete with these islands in their capacity to encourage natural life to develop freely and radically up to its own best potential. More than 9 out of 10 things that grew here grew nowhere else on earth. Why this should have been so remains a mystery. Perhaps a fortunate combination of rainfall, climate, sunlight, and soil accounted for this miracle. Perhaps eons of time in which diverse growing things were left alone to work out their own best destinies was the explanation. Perhaps the fact that when a grass reached here it had to stand upon its own capacities and could not be refertilized by grasses of the same kind from the parent stock. Perhaps that is the explanation. But whatever the reason, the fact remains. In these islands, new breeds developed, and they prospered, and they grew strong, and they multiplied. For these islands were a crucible of exploration and development. And so, with these capacities, the islands waited. Jesus died on a cross, and they waited. England was settled by mixed and powerful races, and the islands waited for their own settlers. Mighty kings ruled in India and in China and in Japan, while the islands waited. Inhospitable, in fact, a paradise in potential, with almost no food available, but with enormous riches waiting to be developed, the islands waited. Volcanoes, still building the ramparts with fresh flows of lava, hung lanterns in the sky so that if a man and his canoe were lost on the great dark bosom of the sea, wandering fitfully this way and that, he might spot the incandescent glow of the underside of a distant cloud, and thus find a fiery star to steer by. Large gannets and smaller terns skimmed across the waters leading to land, while frigate birds drew sharp and sure navigation lines from the turbulent ocean wastes right to the heart of the islands where they nested. If a man in a canoe could spot a frigate bird, its cleft tail cutting the wind, he could be sure that land lay in the direction toward which the bird had flown at dusk. These beautiful islands, waiting in the sun and storm, how much they seemed like beautiful women waiting for their men to come home at dusk, waiting with open arms and warm bodies and consolation. All that would be accomplished in these islands, as in these women, would be generated solely by the will and puissance of some man. I think the islands always knew this. Therefore, men of Polynesia and Boston and China and Mount Fuji and the barrios of the Philippines, do not come to these islands empty-handed or craven in spirit or afraid to starve. There is no food here. In these islands there is no certainty. Bring your own food, your own gods, your own flowers and fruits and concepts. For if you come without resources to these islands, you will perish. But if you come with growing things and good foods and better ideas, if you come with gods that will sustain you, and if you are willing to work until the swimming head and the aching arms can stand no more, then you can gain entrance to this miraculous crucible where the units of nature are free to develop according to their own capacities and desires. On these harsh terms, the islands waited. Chapter 2. From the Sun-Swept Lagoon. I have said that the islands along the rupture in the ocean floor were not a paradise. But 2,400 miles almost due south, there did exist an island which merited that description. It lay northwest of Tahiti, already populated with a powerful, sophisticated people, and only a few miles from the island of Hawaii, the political and religious capital of the area. It was Bora Bora, and it rose from the sea in sharp cliffs and mighty pinnacles of rock. It contained deep-set bays and tree-rimmed shores of glistening sand. It was so beautiful that it seemed impossible that it had arisen by chance. Gods must have formed it and placed the bays just so, an illusion which was enhanced by the fact that around the entire island was hung a protecting necklace of coral on which wild ocean waves broke in high fury, trying vainly to leap inside the placid green lagoon, where fish flourished in abundant numbers. It was an island of rare beauty, wild, impetuous, lovely Bora Bora. Early one morning, while in Paris, the sons of Charlemagne quarreled among themselves as to how their late father's empire should be ruled, a swift, single-hulled outrigger canoe, sped along by sturdy paddlers and a triangular sail, swept across the open ocean leading from Hawaii and sought the solitary entrance to the lagoon of Bora Bora, on whose shores a lookout followed the progress of the urgent canoe with dread. He saw the steersman signal his sailors to drop sail, and as they complied, he watched the canoe pivot deftly in high swells that sought to crash it upon the reef. But with enviable skill, the steersman rowed with the swells and headed his canoe toward the perilous opening in the coral wall. "Now," he shouted, and his paddlers worked feverishly, standing the canoe off from the rocks and speeding it into the channel. There was a rush of water, a rising of huge waves, and a swift, passionate surge of canoe and flashing paddles through the gap. "Rest," the steersman called quietly, in audible relief. Gratified with his minor triumph, he looked for approval to the canoe's solitary passenger, a tall, gaunt man with deep-set eyes, a black beard, and long, thin hands in which he clutched a staff carved with the figures of gods. But the passenger offered no commendation, for he was lost in the contemplation of certain mighty processes which he had helped set in motion. He stared through the steersman, past the paddlers, and onto the towering central rock that marked the heights of Bora Bora. It was from a point partway up the slopes of this rugged mountain that the lookout now rushed down steep paths leading to the king's residence, shouting as he went, "The high priest is returning!" The instinctive dread which the lookout felt was transmitted in his cry, and women who heard the message drew closer to their men and looked at them with new affection across dark, palm-thatched huts. Although the agitated lookout delivered his frightening message to the general community, he was actually speeding to alert one man. And now, as he darted along in the shade of breadfruit trees and palms, he kept whispering to himself, "Gods of Bora Bora, speed my feet. Don't let me be late." Dashing up to a grass house larger than its neighbors, the lookout fell to the ground shouting, "The high priest is in the lagoon." From the grassy interior, a tall, brown-skinned young man, courtier to the king, poked a sleepy head and asked in some alarm, "Already?" "He has passed the reef," the lookout warned. "Why didn't you?" In great agitation, the young man grabbed a ceremonial tapa robe made from pounded bark, and without waiting to adjust it properly, went running toward the palace, crying, "The high priest approaches." He hurried past other courtiers like himself and right into the royal presence, where he prostrated himself on the soft pandanus matting that covered the earthen floor, announcing with urgency, "The August One is about to land." The man to whom these agitated words were addressed was a handsome, large-headed man of 33, whose close-cropped hair showed gray at the temples, and whose unusually wide-spaced eyes were grave with wisdom. If he experienced the same dread at the high priest's return as did his underlings, he masked it. But the tall young courtier nevertheless observed that his master moved with unaccustomed alacrity to the treasure room, where he donned an ankle-length robe of light brown tapa bark, throwing about his left shoulder and around his waist a precious cordon made of yellow feathers, his badge of authority. He then adjusted his feather and shell helmet, while around his neck he placed a chain of shark's teeth. At this appropriate moment, the tall courtier issued a signal, and drums along the shore began to throb in royal rhythms. "We go to honor the high priest," the king announced gravely, waiting while an impressive train of tanned warriors, naked to the waist and wrapped in brown tapa, formed behind him. Almost against his will, the king found himself urging his men, "Hurry, hurry, we must not be tardy." For although everyone acknowledged that he was supreme on Bora Bora, he had found it prudent never to be wanting in courtesies to the spiritual ruler of the island, especially since the attributes and requirements of the new god, Oro, were not yet clearly known. The king's father had underestimated the power of the new deity, and during a solemn convocation in the Temple of Oro, his high priest had suddenly pointed at him as one failing in reverence, and the king's brains had been clubbed in, his body dragged away as the next human sacrifice to red